and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the battle raging inside one of the most powerful political lobbies in the U.S., the NRA, the National Rifle Association, which, thanks to leaked internal documents, is beginning to look more like a self-dealing slush fund for greedy con men with lavish spending habits, rather than a gun rights group representing the rural red state dues payers opposed to the Washington elite and the swamp that Trump, a big NRA backer whose campaign was showered with NRA money, some of which came from Russia, promised to drain. Joshua Horowitz, the executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea, joins us to discuss the battle between Oliver North, the recently fired president of the NRA, and longtime CEO Wayne LaPierre, who North tried to get fired by threatening to expose to the NRA's board LaPierre's excessive spending, such as $275,000 at just one high-end men's clothing store in Beverly Hills. But LaPierre got the better of Trump and had him fired, and now the documents are leaking out, revealing the wholesale looting of the NRA by LaPierre and his cronies, who all the while try to project the image that they are selfless Second Amendment heroes fighting for the little guy to protect his guns from the smug liberal elite who shop in Beverly Hills, not at the local Walmart. Then we'll go to London and speak with Oliver Bullock, a journalist and regular contributor to The Guardian and The New York Times, who has written about Russian history and politics in The Last Man in Russia and Let Our Fame Be Great. He joins us to discuss his new book, Moneyland, Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back, and how the world has been impoverished for the benefit of a few kleptocrats by the fateful decision by some bankers in London in 1962 who changed the world when they came up with the idea of offshore banking. Then finally, we'll explore the contrast between an excess of Democratic candidates running for president and the paucity of qualified Democratic candidates prepared to run to take back the U.S. Senate in 2020. Jim Manley, a Democratic strategist and veteran of the U.S. Senate, where he served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and before that as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy, joins us to discuss this imbalance in focus on trying to capture the White House at the expense of getting electable candidates to run against vulnerable Republicans for Senate seats in 2020. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now, Joshua Horowitz, who's the executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and the Educational Fund to Stop Gun Violence. He has spent more than three decades working on gun violence prevention issues and is the author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Horowitz.
Thanks, Ian. Great to be here.
Well, thanks, Josh. And what do you make of the infighting at the NRA that's now spilled out into the public? From what I can tell, it's a bit of a kind of tabloid story, I guess, in a way, but it seems as if Oliver North basically tried to force the resignation of Wayne LaPierre, and he threatened to expose Wayne LaPierre's excessive spending to the board, and then Wayne LaPierre outmaneuvered him in a kind of bureaucratic battle, which he was much more skilled at than North. And instead of Wayne LaPierre being fired, North got fired. But nevertheless, the documents are coming out. So are we to assume that Oliver North is leaking these documents?
You know, I really don't know who's leaking the documents. There's, you know, now an investigation by the New York State Attorney General. There's lots of dissatisfied former employees and board members. What I'm most surprised about is, look, this has been going on for years. The NRA is not a gun rights organization. It's a money-making operation. It's a pyramid scheme for their for their senior executives. What I'm surprised about, and I've been talking about this for years, but what I'm surprised about is that they broke the thieves' code, right? Which is that as long as no one talks about it, everybody gets rich. Oliver North broke that code, and now everything is spilling out. And I think it's something that we've tried to bring attention to, because it's so contrary to what nonprofits, you know, every other nonprofit in the country does. But Oliver North, you know, opened up these doors, broke the code, and now everybody's going to see what's going on inside the NRA and how antithetical it is to the nonprofit position, to what's called 501c3 public charities in general, and it is as swampy as it can possibly be. The NRA is the swamp where rich executives prey on individual donors giving $20 and $25, and they've taken this money and bought expensive suits and done expensive travel. And, you know, it's really a disgusting organization, and it's really time to dissolve the NRA.
Well, just one men's clothing store in Beverly Hills, Zegna, got $275,000 from Wayne LaPierre. It's almost up there in Paul Manafort territory, isn't it? Spending that kind
Absolutely.
Of money on clothes.
Ostrich jackets, the whole thing, you know, right? But what makes this even worse is that the NRA's public relations firm, Ackerman McQueen, has been bilking the organization for years with excessive bills. People don't realize this, but a lot of the people who look like employees of the NRA are actually work for Ackerman McQueen. And it's just been a way to transfer money from the NRA to a private entity. And that private entity, Ackerman McQueen, is the organization that has ended up paying the bill for the suits. So what's happened is you raid the NRA treasury, give the money to Ackerman McQueen, and then Ackerman McQueen pays for all these perks for the NRA executives. So in addition to the exorbitant salaries that they make, like LaPierre and others, they're now all able to bilk, you know, this Ackerman McQueen, who's making $40, $50 million a year off the NRA, for all this excessive spending and lifestyle things that most nonprofit directors, you know, never get. And that's why when you work for a nonprofit, those are things that you give up because you have a mission, right? The idea, think about this, Ian, the idea that there are donors out there who are giving tax-exempt donations to the NRA Foundation, or the NRA itself doesn't have to pay taxes, and that money is getting transferred to a taxable entity, Ackerman McQueen, and then they get to outside the presence of the normal scrutiny that goes to a nonprofit, spend it like a little piggy bank for the NRA executives. I mean, it is a theme that is just so disgusting.
And again, I'm speaking with Joshua Horowitz, who's the Executive Director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and the Educational Fund to Stop Gun Violence. He has spent more than three decades working on gun violence prevention issues and is the author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea. So just in addition to Wayne LaPierre spending $275,000 on men's clothing at Zegna, a fancy men's store in Beverly Hills, he gets a salary of more than $1.4 million a year, and he bills $267,000 in personal expenses, including flights and limousine services for trips to the Bahamas, Florida, Nevada, Budapest, and an Italian lake resorts. This is all in the leaked documents. And then one year, in year 2015, Wayne LaPierre was paid $5 million for some kind of prepaid retirement package. So these guys really take good care of themselves, don't they? On the dues money from these average gun-loving guys out there in all the red states, right?
It's such a pyramid scheme. It's just incredible. But here's the thing that is just, it's too, it is, you know, it's just a huge lie that the NRA puts out there, that they're fighting against the elites. They're fighting against the people who think they're better than you, the people who, you know, live in the ivory tower. And here's Wayne LaPierre buying $250,000 worth of suits in Beverly Hills and calling people like me and the other people who, you know, who work on this every day and work earnestly on it every day, the quote-unquote elites. Right? You know, I don't have private drivers driving me around to Italian lake resorts. I mean, the whole thing is just completely, the NRA is, you got to understand, and I've written about this before, that the NRA is not a gun rights group. That's the cover. That's the cover for a group of insiders bilking individual donors for their personal aggrandizement. And it's been going on for a long time, and it's disgusting, but what's happening is, I think because of the sort of changing political times and other pressure, that the NRA is, you know, they're falling behind. The donations aren't coming in as they used to. Gun sales are down across the United States. So the manufacturers are, don't have the money that they used to. So the house of cards is sort of falling apart. And my guess is that this whole Oliver North, Wayne LaPierre situation was, oh my gosh, we're each bilking the organization, but maybe now there's not enough money to support each of us, so we need to fight over the spoils. That's probably why Oliver North went and sort of broke the code of thieves, or the code of honor or whatever these guys have, not honorable. But I bet you, my guess is that things are drying up, and so now they're trying to fight over the spoils. But, you know, for people who have watched the NRA for a long time and you listen to insiders who have come out of this, they're out there, you know, saying, this is an emergency. We have to have your money now to fight these elites who are trying to take your guns away, and they're going and spending your money, your NRA dues money, on high-priced suits in Beverly Hills. It's unbelievable.
Well, you mentioned the gun manufacturers. I mean, isn't another way to look at the NRA, apart from being a self-dealing criminal organization, taking care of the executives and abusing the dues of its members, aren't they really a lobbying group for the gun and manufacturing companies? And if they're not selling guns, are they simply not getting the kind of money? Is that, along with the dues, has that been their backbone in terms of being lobbyists for gun and ammunition manufacturers?
Well, yeah, they certainly are. I mean, about 15 years ago, the NRA pushed through Congress during the Bush administration something called the Protection and Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, commonly known as PLACA. And PLACA immunized the gun manufacturers from liability in civil lawsuits. And what basically they said to the manufacturers is, we'll pass this, but you have to have fealty to us once this gets done. And many people think that the manufacturers control the NRA. It's exactly the opposite. The NRA is basically extorts, in my view, money from the manufacturers and says, you have to give us money because we're the ones out there protecting you. And if you don't do that, and there are, I believe, not every gun manufacturer, but some gun manufacturers really do want to do the right thing. They want to do innovation for safety. They only now innovate for lethality, but they want to innovate for safety. They're happy to comply with background check laws around the United States, and they're not necessarily against more regulation. But the NRA has said, you come out against this, and we're going to put you out of business. So they have made the gun manufacturers almost captured, like a captured industry, because the one place where the NRA has economic power is over the gun manufacturers. And so, now, though, when they say, hey, give us money, the problem is that since Trump has been elected president, gun sales are way down 20-30% since the heyday in the last years of the Obama administration. I think for a lot of gun owners, they bought a lot of weapons during the Obama administration, bought AR-15s and other weapons. I think they feel with Trump in the White House, they don't have that much to worry about. So gun sales are down. And that means that some gun manufacturers are going out of business. Their margins are a lot smaller. and they don't have the available cash to help the NRA out as much. And so the NRA is now, you know, I think their dues are down, the industry's down, their political clout is down. There's a lot more spending going on by the Gun Violence Prevention Group. I think, Michael Bloomberg spending a lot of money on elections has put pressure on the NRA to spend more on elections to keep up. And, you know, they're really financially in trouble. So against the backdrop of their leaders bilking the organization, you know, you have sort of this perfect storm of, that's why you got this internecine fight between North and LaPierre.
Well, at this point, at least one of the board members, and that's the former Congressman Alan West, he's calling for Wayne LaPierre's resignation. I don't know whether that's going to snowball, but what about going back a little bit? I mean, one of the things that's revealed in these leaked documents is Wayne LaPierre was paying for the apartment for a young intern in McLean, Virginia for a number of years. Now she's apparently on the NRA staff. There's an implication there that there may have been more than a paternal relationship going on there. There's also Maria Butina, the young Russian girl that's now facing jail time. She was involved with the NRA and looks like Torshin, her Russian oligarch who was her mentor, was using the NRA to funnel Russian money into the Trump campaign. Where does that one stand?
So on the first issue, I don't know anything. I mean, I think it's unusual for a nonprofit, but I just don't know anything about that first issue. On the second issue about Maria Butina, I follow that extremely closely. This information, almost all the information that has come out was known before the 2016 elections. I was following that and screaming at anybody who had listened that the NRA had become infiltrated by Russian moles. And that was because Butina and Torshin were very deeply involved in that. All you had to do is Google Torshin to know that he had been, you know, money laundering in Spain, was almost barely made out of Spain. And the idea that if you look at those meetings, the NRA meetings that happened in Russia in 2015, where that Butina organized, and you got the former president, time Larry Keane, and other NRA officials, they weren't just meeting with Butina and Torshin. They had assistant secretaries of defense in Russia at those meetings. Anybody I've heard it described, it's basically, you know, a honeypot situation where you lay out a situation, people come to Russia, you get compromised. It's very obvious. The idea that the NRA didn't recognize that, or maybe recognized it and then said, wow, maybe we could use this to our advantage, maybe they'll funnel money to us. Now, it's never been proved that money was funneled right through the NRA, but the NRA had a lot of money that year, and clearly Butina and Torshin were trying to use the NRA as cover to infiltrate the conservative movement. I don't know if we'll ever know whether the money was funneled, because a lot of that money that the NRA spent in 2016 is what we call dark money. It came not from the disclosed election accounts, but from their C4, which is, you can't trace the donors of that. So, but, you know, regardless of whether there was actually money filed, the idea that flowed, the idea that you let Butina infiltrate your organization when she so clearly was on a mission from Russia just shows how corrupt that organization was. Their former president, David Keane, was even a business partner with Maria Butina. Like, what do you need to do to, you know, how, this is supposed to be a sophisticated organization falling for this clearly obvious Russian operation that I'm no expert in this, but when I saw it going in the fall of 2016, I was just flabbergasted that the NRA would let this happen to them. And you know, we may never know the extent of all of this, but it just shows an organization absolutely corrupt to its core, with a sign that says, open for business, whatever money, you know, whatever we can do to self-enrich ourselves, we'll do. That's what it says to me. And that's, again, why the NRA, we need to dissolve the NRA.
Well, just in closing, you mentioned earlier, Josh, because I know 501c3s are policed by the nonprofits, you know, foundations. I have one called the Public Truth Media Foundation. And there are very strict rules. You can't self-deal. You can't pay yourself huge salaries and all that stuff. So you've explained how they got around it by using this advertising agency as a kind of cutout. But that still doesn't mean that Wayne LaPierre is not subject to the IRS auditing him. I bet he didn't declare all of those suits, $275,000 that he spent at one Beverly Hills men's store. That's effectively income, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, all that's income, right? So, you know, there's so many ramifications from individual tax liability for Wayne LaPierre and for others, I'm sure, but also for the nonprofit status of the NRA. And so, like I said, just because they use this cutout, they intentionally, you know, they obviously intentionally transferred money. And the self-dealing is one thing that's a problem. The exorbitant salaries are another problem. The poor bookkeeping is another. Using money not for your charitable mission. You have there's issues, you know, the NRA has the NRA Foundation, which is a 501c3. The NRA itself is a 501c4. The 501c4 is tax exempt, but donations to it are not tax exempt. The 501c3 actually is allowed to write off donations to that. So there's some rules around all of this. Most of them around self-dealing and sticking to the charitable purposes of the organization. But under any standard, they violated the NRA, the board of directors, the executive director has violated their duty to the organization and just used it as a piggy bank. And that's something that the IRS cannot allow to happen. And NRA is also a New York corporation, and I'm sure that the Attorney General of New York, who's investigating the NRA, is looking for those violations, both in the charity, which is a C3, and the social welfare organization, which is the C4, the NRA itself. And there are some very strict rules, and I would think that their nonprofit status is in serious jeopardy.
Well, Joshua Horowitz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's always my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Joshua Horowitz, who's the executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and the Education Fund to Stop Gun Violence. He has spent more than three decades working on gun violence prevention issues and is the author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the author of the new book, Moneyland, Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back. Is a warm gun. Choo-choo. Happiness is a warm gun, mama. Choo-choo. When I hold you in my arms, oh, yeah. And I feel my finger on your trigger, oh, yeah. I know nobody can do me no harm. Oh, yeah. There's a place I don't. The edge of town, sir, rising above the factories and the fields. Ever since I was a child, I can remember the mansion on the hill. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Oliver Bullock, who is a journalist and regular contributor to The Guardian, The New York Times, and GQ. He has authored two nonfiction books about Russian history and politics, The Last Man in Russia and Let Our Fame Be Great. And his latest book just out is Moneyland, Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back. Welcome to Background Briefing, Oliver Bullock.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. And you could make the case that at this point, the world is dominated by two money launderers, Donald Trump in the White House and Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin. If you look at Trump's rise to become a billionaire, even though there's some doubt about that to begin with, a lot of the money stolen from the coffers of the KGB ended up in New York real estate. A lot of it was laundered through Trump properties. And Putin, from what I understand, has something like $160 billion stashed abroad. So is that what the world has come down to? Two money launderers dominating the globe?
Well, I'd caution you against thinking it was just two, to be honest. I think that part of the strange dynamic of the last few years is that there are some kleptocrats, some giant thieves who are quite happy to publicize what they're up to, of whom obviously Vladimir Putin is the most extreme example, but there are others as well. But there are also a large number of kleptocrats who don't decide to do what Putin has done and essentially show off the magnitude of his crimes. And in, to my mind, those ones, of whom I would say most of the ruling elite in China are the most obvious examples, are actually far more dangerous. I mean, at least with Putin, we know that the amount of money he owns is a known unknown, right? But the amount of money that is owned by the ruling elite in China is an entirely unknown unknown. So I don't know. I would caution you against thinking there are just two of these powerful people with shady origin fortunes. There are a lot of them. Just most of them prefer to remain in the shadows and operate in a background way. And it's just that those two you mentioned, both of them have a significant publicity machine, which is why we talk about them so much.
Sure. Well, but I think you could make the case that the world is now beset not by ideological struggles like we had during the Cold War, but essentially by a struggle between creeping kleptocracy and the undermining of frail democracies and rule of law and democratic traditions. And the Russians are doing well in terms of, at least Putin, for a £9 million investment through the so-called insurance character, Aaron Banks, through his Russian former prostitute wife. That was a pretty good investment if you look at how the UK is paralyzed by Brexit. And if Stephen Bannon, with Russian money, is able to get these right-wing parties in Europe elected in the upcoming European elections, they'll be able to paralyze the EU. And again, we're not talking about a big investment, but just to broaden it out a little bit, if the United States is a bastion of democracy and it's got a criminal in charge of it and a possible traitor, and you've got these operations going on with Bannon and Putin in Europe that could weaken the EU, isn't that a major step backwards for democracy and a major step forward for kleptocracy?
And I completely agree with your analysis that, you know, ideological differences, I mean, you know, I suppose there's a debate about how significant or how deeply held those ideologies really were at the time. But, you know, the fig leaf of ideology has been stripped away and we have been left with this essentially a contrast between, you know, what you might call the rule of law and the rule of men, because they do tend to be men. That's absolutely right, between kleptocracy and democracy. I have to say, though, I mean, this is a weird thing for me to say, being as I am a Russianist, and I should always be delighted by the attention when Russia gets in the spotlight, because it gives me more opportunities to write op-eds and to generally opine on national radio. I am concerned by the relentless focus on Russia, because if all it takes is £9 million to hijack a political process in the UK, and all it takes is a few dozen of million dollars to hijack a political process in the United States, that suggests to me that our democracies were in a very fragile state to begin with. I think that this assault on the rule of law and this attempt to return to a time when power is decided between powerful individuals and not decided impartially by courts, that this has been going on for a long time. And, it's been going on for a number of decades now. And essentially the bad guys have been winning for a long time, but Putin has just given it a face. He is such a recognizable bad guy. He looks like a Bond villain. He delights in being a bad guy. So we've able to put a name on this phenomenon. But actually the reason why our democracies are so vulnerable to being hijacked by a relatively small amount of money from Eastern Europe is because they've been being chipped away at for a long time by our own domestic kleptocrats. But our domestic kleptocrats prefer to remain in the shadows. It's just that Putin delights in the limelight.
And again, I'm speaking with Oliver Bullock, who is a journalist and regular contributor to The Guardian, The New York Times, and GQ. He has authored two nonfiction books about Russian history and politics, The Last Man in Russia and Let Our Fame Be Great. And his latest book just out is Moneyland, Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back. No, I think your point is well taken, Oliver, that, the joke's on us. If Putin is able to divide us here and turn us against each other, it's our problem. He's just benefiting from our problem. But in terms of how to reverse this tide. Your book basically takes us back to 1962, when bankers in London had this idea, which they called offshore banking. And isn't that at the heart of the problem, is that there are just trillions of dollars stashed offshore that's both dirty kleptocratic money from third world countries and from the looted spoils of Russia and China, etc. But it's also mixed in with big corporations, multinationals hiding their wealth from the tax man and wealthy individuals. And it's all commingled. And this money's not doing anybody any good except the kleptocrats. It's not helping in terms of social democracy and social welfare.
The joy of offshore is that it allows you to enjoy all the benefits of being a citizen without any of the responsibilities. So you get to live in sunny California or in not so sunny London, and you get to enjoy the sort of the public security. You get to enjoy the world class art galleries, the healthcare, the education, all the things which ordinary Americans or ordinary Brits get to enjoy. But you don't have to pay for any of those things, and that's the great thing that offshore can give to someone who's wealthy enough to afford its services. So yes, when this was invented in the 1960s, it was a tremendous boon for wealthy people from all Western countries who liked the stability and security and just the sort of quality of life that you got in the West, but didn't want to have to pay the entrance fee, which is the taxes, which you've got to pay to support it. And then once these tools were invented for tax avoiders, tax evaders in the 1960s, they were then offered to kleptocrats, first of all in sort of the former colonies in sub-Saharan Africa, and then gradually as the world opened up to the former Soviet Union and to China and so on. So yeah, offshore is the invention that broke the world. It was invented. There's a line by Dean Acheson, the former U.S. Secretary of State. He actually said it in the winter of 1963 at a speech at West Point, when he said that Britain is a country that has lost an empire but is yet to find a role. And the great irony of that speech, which I think was entirely correct, was that at the very time he said it, the British bankers were just brewing the most potent distillation of offshore, which is what they called a Eurobond, which is a sort of stateless, taxless bond that allowed kleptocrats to invest their money and get a good return entirely tax-free and totally scrutiny-free. So yes, it is an invention created by London as a post-empire situation, and then it has spread around the world. I was just two weeks ago, I was in South Dakota, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, which is a great place, let's face it, a small town in a small city in a very sparsely populated state. It has a rapidly growing trust industry, which grows by about $80 billion every year, and it's attracting money from all over the world. It is, one of the newest of the tax havens. Moneyland is endlessly mutating. It used to be in the Bahamas. It used to be in the British Virgin Islands and so on. Now it's much more likely to be in Nevada or South Dakota, places like that. It's always moving. It's always looking for new opportunities. And basically what it means is that the rich and the powerful, the rich and the unscrupulous, get to duck out of having any responsibilities and get to just enjoy all the privileges of funding elections, of passing laws, of living high on the hog while leaving the rest of us to pay for it.
And has there been any studies done on the difference it would be if this money were repatriated here in the United States in terms of helping the standard of living and the federal deficit, for that matter? Do we know what percentage of taxable income we're losing here that could otherwise benefit the broader population as opposed to a handful of people?
It's very difficult to say because, as I say, this is an incredibly sophisticated industry. I mean, there were studies that were made back in the so 10 years ago, at the height of the financial crisis by Congress, that were suggesting the U.S. was losing approximately $100 billion every year in taxable income to foreign tax havens. And that led the federal government to really crack down very hard, above all on Switzerland, but subsequently on others, the Bahamas and so on, which led to a lot of money being repatriated. But that money has been repatriated, as I said, to places like South Dakota, places like Nevada, which don't have income taxes of their own. They have trusts that live, if not forever, then effectively forever. So you see a sort of a strange phenomenon of offshore being brought onshore, whereas the US now has domestic tax havens, which are every bit as potent, if not more potent, than any of the tax havens that you used to have overseas in the sort of you know, sunny places for shady people in the Caribbean that are so well known. And in fact, places like Wyoming, South Dakota, Nevada are just as potent as they ever were, but they've gone almost entirely under the radar. You know, the amount of money held in trust in South Dakota has risen in the last 10 years from about $50 billion to almost $300 billion. That's approximately 400% increase in just a decade. And most of that money is of domestic origin. That's US money is being put there to dodge taxes. So it is, as I say, the problem of offshore is a far more complicated one than we often give it credit for. We think that if we can just crack down on an island with palm trees and white beaches, the problem will be solved. That isn't the case at all. There is an endless demand among wealthy people for these tax-free, scrutiny-free products. And if you can't get them in the Caribbean, then they look elsewhere, and so they get them in South Dakota instead.
Well, of course, for the longest time, the state of Delaware has also been a tax haven and a way that you can set up these corporate shingles. And of course, a former senator from Delaware is now running for president. In fact, he's the Democratic frontrunner.
It's actually one of the most depressing facts about the last presidential race is that both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton ran their personal businesses via a shell company in the state of Delaware. You know, speaking as someone who's quite keen for these issues to be resolved, that was a pretty clear example that there was no prospect of it being resolved. And yes, absolutely, the prospect of a senator from Delaware becoming president, you know, even in the circumstances when that meant Donald Trump wouldn't be president anymore, also suggests to me that there would be, you know, minimal prospect of the problem being solved.
But when you create these LLCs, these shingles, for the want of a better description, in Delaware and elsewhere, isn't there a way to get around it, to pass laws, to find out who the actual beneficiary is instead of some named company like, you know, the Mum and Apple Pie Corporation?
I mean, technically there is. There is, in fact, a bill currently being discussed in Washington that would try and solve this problem, certainly for corporations. I mean, in fact, if any of your listeners want to check out the FACT, the FACT Coalition website, that is one of the groups that's really been pushing that. And they need all the support they can get. But it is a very significant uphill struggle. You know, I've spoken to a guy who makes his living forming corporations in Nevada, which is another one of these sort of onshore, offshore tax havens. You know, he said to me, listen, I mean, I could check where people come from, but there's not a lot of money in checking, so I don't really bother. You know, that's the situation you're up against. It's so cheap, it's so easy to create a company in these places that why would anyone bother creating one anywhere else? You could create a company in the state of California, but you can create one next door in Nevada. It's going to be much less paperwork and much cheaper, so why not do it there instead? You know, it is a real issue and you need a federal-wide solution, but, you know, this can be essentially obstructed by the states at almost any turn. It's one of the strange intricacies of your magnificent constitution. And that's just corporations. Once you get past corporations, you have to start dealing with trusts. And trusts are even more knotty, even more complicated. How do you establish who the beneficiary of a trust is? There are many different kinds. You know, the rich and the unscrupulous have been playing this game far longer than we've even been aware that it's a game. And so they've created structures and created pathways that we are only just discovering now. You know, there is an awful lot of money that's gone down the rabbit hole and into Moneyland. You know, if you read a book like, you know, Jane Mayer book, The Dark Money, or Nancy McLean's book, Democracy in Chains, you'll realize that the wealthiest members of society in the U.S. have been at this since the 1960s themselves. You know, so they are a long way ahead of us. And we're only just beginning to try and even understand what they've been up to, let alone catch up with it and try and put a stop to it.
And again, I'm speaking with Oliver Bullock, a journalist and regular contributor to The Guardian, The New York Times, and GQ. His latest book just out is Moneyland, Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back. And Oliver, tell me about the kleptocracy tours. You're a tour guide in London for these kleptocracy tours. And of course, Clearly it has a lot to do with the work that you've been doing and your book, Moneyland, Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back.
Yeah, so I mean, we base these tours on something a bit closer to home where you are, which is the Hollywood tours. You know, when you can go in a bus and see the house where Scarlett Johansson lives or Charlie Chaplin used to live or whatever. But we decided to model that for London. London is the world capital, along with New York, for kleptocratic money, for where the money from Russia and China and Malaysia and Nigeria ends up. So yeah, you go on a bus and we show you around and we point out where these people live, you know, what the properties they own, you know, where they launder their money, where their shell companies are. That's the point. I mean, they're a lot of fun, although I do say so myself, but the idea is to try and expose, you know, the reality of what's happening in London and the fact that we've been accepting this money and not asking any questions at all about where it comes.
Well, you mentioned earlier that there's too much focus on the Russian kleptocrats and on Putin, and Putin himself is just, you know, in your face and proud of how he's meddled in our elections, even though he denies it. And he, of course, he did get pretty upset about the Panama Papers, where
he certainly did. It exposed one of his closest friends who mysteriously, though a cellist, mysteriously had access to $2 billion. So, yeah, I mean, who wouldn't be upset?
Right. But on your kleptocracy tours of London, you also show the mansions of Middle East political dynasties and these $100 million apartments for corrupt African politicians, etc. So it's across the board, right? Why is it that they all come to London, though? What's the deal there?
It's from a money's perspective. You know, if the money comes from, you know, Nigeria, Malaysia, Venezuela, wherever, it doesn't care. You know, the money, it doesn't care where it comes from. It gets laundered in the same way, moved in the same way, and ends up in the same places. And, you know, in terms of the final destination for the money, there's really only two countries that count, and that's where you are in the US and where I am in the UK. And this is where the money likes to end up. Why does it come here? Well, you know, we speak English. We've got good courts. We've got good schools, good universities, good airports, and good restaurants, good art galleries, and it's safe. You know, it's not going to be taken away. We have a shamefully bad record when it comes to prosecuting these people. You know, and yeah, so we are an equal opportunity country. If you've stolen money, as long as you're rich, you're very welcome. That's basically the message that we should be putting on our tourist promotion literature.
So could you describe this phenomenon then as a new form of financial colonization?
Yeah, I think you probably can in a way. You essentially have, you know, colonies became independent and kind of became colonized by their own new rulers with the active cooperation of the financial institutions of the former colonizing powers. So, you know, there is a lot of connection between former British colonies and London, but it goes beyond that. Because obviously the Russians, the Ukrainians, the Azeris and so on, they haven't been colonized by the Brits, but they put their money here too. It's become kind of everybody, the money that the market is truly transnational. And that's what I call Moneyland. It's essentially all of these very wealthy people, wherever they come from. It's like they're living in a country of their own, a country of the very rich, where they have their own rules and their own, you know, standards of living. And they are essentially entirely immune to the efforts of the rest of us of bringing them to some form of account.
And again, I'm speaking with Oliver Bullock, a journalist and regular contributor to The Guardian, The New York Times, and GQ. His latest book just out is Moneyland, Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back. So in terms of the relationship, we started the conversation talking about the opaque relationship between Trump and Putin and who who owns who, you know. But there was an hour and a half phone conversation last week between the two of them. And of course, we don't know what goes on in their meetings in face to face. There's simply no records of what is talked about. But I'm curious to get your take, Oliver, on the trajectory that we're on in terms of kleptocracy, where there's such transfers of wealth from Russia and China into these offshore banks and into countries like the United States and the UK because of their financial stability, and how much it is impeding these countries. I mean, we're all concerned about, at least a lot of people are concerned about China becoming the next global hegemon. But as long as the Chinese elite park their money abroad and send their kids abroad to be educated, you wonder about what kind of confidence their leaders have in the future of their own country. And we know that Putin is looting, and the Siloviki and his oligarchs are looting Russia exorbitantly. So, for example, you know, what do you think's going on in the conversations with both Trump and Putin and Pompeo and Lavrov about Iran? Do you think the Russians are really trying to help the United States get out of a mess or not get into a mess? Like, you know, let's use a little diplomacy. Or do you think Putin would be encouraging the more reckless and ignorant side of Donald Trump by not necessarily encouraging him to go to war in Iran? But if there was a war in the Gulf and the Gulf would be shut down pretty quickly, we know who would be the beneficiary of that. Oil prices would go through the ceiling, and Russia, since it's a one-resource country, would suddenly become a lot richer, and there'd be more money for Putin to steal and more money to trickle down to placate the Russian people.
Yeah, I mean, there are many, many aspects of that story. Obviously, it's multidimensional. But I think the thing that the most important thing to focus on always with regard to these stories is that the money that these people have, whether that's Putin or the Chinese elite or the Iranian elite, to be honest, or the Saudi elite, is inherently transnational, right? It begins in one country. It's laundered through a handful of other countries. It ends up in New York or Miami or Los Angeles or London or wherever. You know, that's how it happens. So this is, in order to move this money, it's transnational. In order to track it down and confiscate it, or to try and stop these passages, that's also transnational. It requires international cooperation between the US and the UK and the tax havens and Switzerland and whatever. So Putin's interest, I think, to be honest, I think Donald Trump's interest, I think the interest of a lot of the people backing Brexit here in the UK is to try and shut this cooperation down. If they can spread distrust between countries, if they can atomize global society and make countries start, you know, distrusting each other rather than cooperating with each other, that's good for them because it means their money can move unhindered because you won't have the kind of global transnational cooperation that is required to trace these money movements and then to try and put a stop to them. So I think a lot of these, authoritarian leaders in the world now, whether that's Duterte in the Philippines or Erdogan in Turkey or Orban in Hungary or the Brexit leaders here in Russia or Putin or Trump or whoever, they are trying to put up walls. They're trying to atomize global society because that is the way to prevent any form of investigation of their movement of their wealth. And the wealth is what's most important to them. So I think we as citizens need to keep our eyes on the prize and just try and ignore their effort to distract us and look at what's most important, which is that they are stealing everything, including the chairs we're sitting down on. And we need to make sure that we stop them doing that.
So is Steve Bannon a useful idiot for the kleptocrats in the sense that he's stoking nationalism, which is the opposite of the idea of a European Union?
I'm not sure he's an idiot. I think he's a very highly paid idiot, if idiot is indeed the word. I mean, I think a lot of these, you know, the what you might term the propagandists for authoritarianism, the propagandists for atomizing the world and preventing global cooperation, are very highly paid for it. You know, it's a very profitable business. I think that it is very cynical. I think it's done knowingly, and it's done with full knowledge of what the actual driver of what they're doing is. They are acting on behalf of what I call the class of moneylenders, the class of the sort of global 0.1%, who are the true people who benefit from globalization when the rest of us essentially are either unaffected by it or harmed by it.
So, Oliver, we have a money-driven system here in the United States in terms of our politics. And, you know, your elections, what they last for a few weeks. Ours last for a couple of years. We're already in the midst of the 2020 race with, you know, an extraordinary number of Democratic hopefuls running against Donald Trump, and billions are going to be spent. And, of course, our legislators are essentially telemarketers. They spend most of their days asking for money, dialing for dollars, and then that money ends up going to people like Rupert Murdoch and other media monopolies to spend on television advertising. So that's a quick sketch of our money-driven politics. So how do you fix this system, which we mentioned earlier? The problem with offshore money is that criminal and kleptocratic money is mingled with the money from wealthy individuals avoiding their taxes. And these same wealthy individuals who are avoiding their taxes are also the same people who buy our politicians. So how do you break that knot?
I think the most important thing is we need to know who owns what. It is far, far, far too easy for anyone to incorporate themselves and to use that incorporation to essentially remove their fingerprints from the property they own. And once they remove their fingerprints, they can use that property, you know, their money to influence elections, to buy influence, to fund politicians, and essentially, you know, to be secret money, which is doing secret things. There is a great line in Harry Potter. I don't know if you're a Harry Potter fan. There's a line in Harry Potter and Mr. Weasley is warning his daughter against a possessed diary. And he says, how many times must I tell you never trust anything that can think for itself if you can't see where it keeps its brain? And I think that is a lesson which we should all heed, to be honest, because a lot of the money that is currently in our politics is money that can think for itself, but we can't see where it keeps its brain. We need to strip away these anonymous LLCs and start seeing who it is who's actually, you know, the puppet master behind all this subterfuge. And once we see that, we'll actually really understand what's going on. And I think that will make it much easier to understand the true dynamics of who's paying, who's buying, and what they're getting for it. And that will mean that we make it much harder for this very form of sort of Western corruption, what you've described of the funding of politics, the funding of politicians, make it much harder for it to function. And that, to me in mind, that is the most important thing that anyone can do in any country is true transparency of ownership, which means we will now know who's funding what and who's doing what and what they want for it.
Well, of course, recently after the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court, they were able to, the super wealthy were able to create 501c4 tax-exempt vehicles, supposedly for social welfare, that enable billionaires to donate unrestricted amounts of money with total anonymity. That's our system. And on today's program, we were also talking about the battles within the NRA, the National Rifle Association, which have been a powerful lobby here, and a lot of money going into them has been funneled through these 501c4s. So that is the new vehicle here. So it would indicate that politically and in terms of the law, we're moving in the opposite direction. But your advice is definitely well taken here. Just in closing, Oliver, what can you tell our audience about why they should get your book? I know why they should, but I'd like to hear it from you.
To my mind, there are two great threats that face our civilization. One of them is climate change, of course, and the other one is the threat of dirty money, dark money, the increasing proportion of the world's resources that are dominated by an unaccountable globalized elite, the sort of what I call moneylanders, people who have no real tie to any particular country, who keep their money wherever it suits them best. This is a real threat to democracy. You know, this concentration of wealth, the concentration of power, makes it very, very hard for any democratic society to function. You know, the United States is, you know, the world's premier democracy, the arsenal of democracy, the leader of the Western world. You know, you are obviously at the forefront of this fight. And it's very, very important, I think, for everyone in the US to understand what you're up against. Everyone is gunning for you. If the kleptocrats can take down the US, then they can take down the rest of us. So I, obviously I would like you to read my book because I'm proud of the book, but also I would like you to read the book because I want you to understand what it is that is threatening you as a society and you as a democracy, because, you know, it is a massive threat. And I worry profoundly that hardly anyone has a sufficient understanding of how serious it is and how imminent it is. It is a real and present danger to the persistence and the maintenance of democracy in the United States. And frankly, speaking as a non-American, but someone who's very fond of America, if democracy goes where you are, then the rest of us don't have much of a chance.
Well, Oliver Bullock, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Oliver Bullock, who's a journalist and regular contributor to The Guardian, The New York Times, and GQ. He's authored two nonfiction books about Russian history and politics, The Last Man in Russia and Let Our Fame Be Great. And his latest book just out is Moneyland, Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back exploring the contrast between an excess of Democratic candidates running for president and the paucity of qualified Democratic candidates prepared to run to take back the U.S. Senate in 2020.
International crime, offshore banking business. I'm your choice. I wanna be elected. I'm Yankee Doodle Dandy in a gold Rolls Royce. I wanna be elected. Kids want a savior and don't need a fake. I wanna be elected.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Jim Manley, a DC-based independent public affairs consultant, Democratic strategist, and 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate, where he served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for his last 6 years of those of his term in the Senate, and before that, served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Manley.
Once again, thank you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Jim. And what do you make of this peculiar disconnect between an excess of candidates, Democratic candidates running for president, and the paucity of qualified Democratic candidates prepared to run to take back the United States Senate in 2020?
You know, I got to tell you, Ian, the more I think about it, the more frustrated I get. I think it comes down to either one of two options. Number one, all of these folks think that Donald Trump's going to win, which I think is a bad miscalculation. Or number two, I think they're looking at the Senate and saying to themselves, you know, I don't need to put up with that. And, you know, as a 21-year veteran of the Senate, you know, I can appreciate the that to a degree. As you and I have talked about before, the fact of the matter is the Senate is broken. But I think for them to throw away all of their chances to run for some misguided effort to be the next president of the United States is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, we're in, you know, the fact of the matter is, Ian, again, as you and I have talked about before, you know, the Senate is the crucible to try to protect this country. And, you know, if we don't flip the Senate, you know, bad things are, even more bad things are going to be right around the corner.
Well, not the least of which is more very, very far right-wing judges from the Federalist Society.
Exactly. And so let's peel that back a layer. I mean, we just saw 2 days ago that the Supreme Court of the United States is prepared to reverse past precedent, so-called stare decisis, and overturn long-held rulings. Now, if you're an abortion rights supporter, for instance, and if you're looking at the Supreme Court to try and protect your rights, you know, you got another thing coming. So the only thing standing between a successful effort to overturn abortion rights, for instance, and a whole host of other things for that later, labor laws, et cetera, is going to be the United States Senate. And I really, really hope, you know, some of these folks reconsider and decide to run for the Senate instead, because, you know, it's a real crucial time in our country and in our history. And, you know, we don't, quite frankly, we don't have time for these foolish little errands. You know, the fact of the matter is that 22 people are running. That's flat out ridiculous. So, again, I just hope that some of these folks reconsider, because we desperately need to reclaim the Senate.
Well, an example of what I see as a kind of disconnect here, Jim Manley, is the latest to enter the race, Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana, which is a red state, but yet he's a Democrat, and he's very popular in the state. And I mean, I don't see him having a snowball's chance with all these other candidates, and you've got Joe Biden way ahead of everybody else any rate at this point.
But to be clear, you know, we'll have to wait and see how this Biden phenomenon plays out. I just want to be crystal clear, but I agree that, you know, the initial polling shows him pulling away, and probably more importantly for what we're talking about, the rest of the pack falling farther and farther behind. Yeah, I mean, you can easily get up to three people that are running for the Senate, I mean, they're running for president, that should be running for the House. Steve Bullock is one, Stacey Abrams is another, and Beto O'Rourke would be the third, all of which could be extremely viable candidates in Senate races. Instead, you know, again, I think they're just wasting their time and their energy for whatever reason, throwing their hat in the ring to try and be the next president of the United States. Trump is eminently beatable, but again, I just, you know, for some reason, you know, Republicans have taken the Senate more seriously than Democrats do when it comes to the Senate. You know, if it's not obvious by now that the Senate's the bulwark, I don't know what to tell folks. I mean, we simply have got to reclaim the Senate.
And as we pointed out, and as the Republicans surely know, since they seem to be concerned about the Supreme Court, if you control the Senate, you control the courts. And Trump's only legacy that's not a complete disaster, not that this legacy will be a disaster, but the only legacy apart from the wrecking crew will be in history was how many judges he got on the courts.
Absolutely. Week in, week now, since Senator McConnell executed his latest so-called nuclear option to undermine the rules of the Senate, the fact of the matter is that the Senate is processing and or confirming one highly qualified nominee after another, not only for the district court, but for the Court of Appeals as well. Before our very eyes, Republicans are reshaping the court. And unfortunately, a lot of it's getting lost in the daily 24-hour news cycle that's, the Trump machine. So I just can't urge your listeners enough to just really focus on the Senate. We just simply have got to do a better job of trying to flip the Senate.
So given we just mentioned Montana, where you could pick up a Democratic seat in a red state, if Steve Bullock, who's the most popular Democrat arguably in the state, were not running for president, I think he's the 22nd or 23rd to join that field. And then you've got other races in Georgia, Maine, Colorado, North Carolina. You mentioned Stacey Abrams. You also mentioned Beto O'Rourke. Mm-hmm. John Cornyn is vulnerable. Beto O'Rourke came pretty close to beating Ted Cruz, did he not? So there's another example. Has Stacey Abrams ruled herself out?
I don't believe she has, no, which leading to some consternation. I don't claim to know what she's up to, but, it pains me to say this, but I think because I love the Senate as an institution and I got so lucky in my career to spend so much time working for some great folks, but, I think they're taking a look at the Senate and saying that it's absolutely broken. They're not passing legislation. All they're doing is confirming judges. The amendment process is broken. You can't get a fair shake in hearings. So, something's got to give, but for some of these folks to walk away from these fights because, they think that, they can be the next president of the United States is, as I've mentioned earlier, just simply misguided. I get the idea, that folks have an ego that they think they can be the next president of the United States. I used to walk onto the Senate floor every day when I worked for Senator Reid. I'd look around and say to myself that, kind of chuckle and or laugh and think, each and every one of these senators thinks that he or she could be the next president of the United States. And for some of those folks, it was absolutely ridiculous, needless to say. So, I get the drive and the desire, but I really, hope some of these folks reconsider, as I mentioned earlier, and think about running for the Senate.
So, I mentioned the states of Iowa, Georgia, Maine, Colorado, North Carolina being Senate seats that the Democrats could pick up. They're certainly up for grabs. Senator Martha McSally, recently appointed in Arizona, she is vulnerable. Joni Ernst in Iowa is vulnerable. Is there any way, and we mentioned John Cornyn in Texas, is there any way that the field of Democrats, this really, crowded field, could be winnowed a little bit? Could they then realize, have they come to Jesus moment and say, well, I'm not going to make it. Maybe I should, let's assume, say that Beto realizes that Mayor Pete is stealing a march on him and he's not going to make it. Do you think at what point could he switch and put his hat in the ring for the Senate?
Yeah, technically, to be clear, I don't know the answer to that, but here's the overarching theory that I have. You know, we as a party at this point in time have no real leader, and that's not a knock on Speaker Pelosi, that's not a knock on Senator Schumer, that's not a knock on my friend Tom Perez at the DNC, but the fact of the matter is we don't have a party apparatus, we don't have a leader with enough clout and or authority to try and clear the field like maybe could have happened in years past. There are no more smoke-filled back rooms where leaders cut deals and, force folks to step aside. Maybe Senator Schumer, who's awfully persuasive, can start, hammering on some of these folks to take a step aside, but they're going to have the individual folks running are going to have this epiphany on their own because, like I said, we don't have the party leaders with the clout necessary to try and clear the field. So it's going to have to happen on its own. So, so what do we know? We've got a series of God knows how many debates starting at some point in June. I don't expect to see much out of them except for a circus-like atmosphere myself. But we'll see if folks start taking their cues right around then, combined with, the lack of fundraising, and they'll try and make some decisions then. But for the time being, it's full speed ahead for all of these guys.
Well, of course, it wouldn't look that good if a candidate looked like he was losing the race for the presidency and then sort of decided
to take the right-wing noise machine, but yes, the right-wing noise machine will have a field day with the so-called flip-flop, no doubt
right.
about it, and that's going to be have to be factored into their decision-making process.
So in other words, you're running for the consolation prize.
Exactly. Yep.
Right.
What happened to your idea of running for president? Now you're just going back and trying to tell your constituents, oops, never mind, I wanted to run for the Senate after all. It won't be easy. I can't deny that, but a skillful politician can pull it off. By simply drawing a contrast because between their views and the right and the extreme right wing views of the Republican Party and or Donald Trump. In the end, this is going to be a referendum on Donald Trump. He is, if he's at all skilled at all, which I think is questionable, will try and make it on the economy. But since he's unable to focus on any one topic at any point in time, I think in the end it's going to come down to Trump. And if you play off that, I think he can be successful, at least in a handful of states, that are up for grabs.
And another one that I didn't mention, along with Montana, with Steve Bullock, Iowa, and Texas, there's also another candidate running who seems like an awfully long shot to me, Hickenlooper. He could also be running, could he not, John Hickenlooper?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I haven't looked into Colorado that much to see, yes is the answer. Sure, he could be challenging the current Republican senator, absolutely.
Quite frankly,
that's in the tier of folks that I'm just simply not paying attention to. I mean, I don't want to insult any of your listeners out there, but this election is for all the marbles, and I, for one, don't have any time for long shots like that. So
what's going on, though? Why don't they? Why are they on this kind of quixotic quest for the presidency, tilting at windmills when there are much better and more realistic chances of becoming U.S. senators? Is it the fear that they would still be in the minority? Because you just made the point, Jim Manley, that nothing's getting done in the Senate. Mitch McConnell has got it bottled up. All they do is rubber stamp the Federalist Society list of judges. Nobody can do a damn thing because you got a do-nothing majority leader. Is that what it is, that there's no fun being in the minority?
Well, yes. Ultimately, I think that's the bottom line. That's certainly what I've been telling folks that have been asking me in the last couple of days. And again, it pains me to have to say that. But, the cynical view, let's do the charitable view, first of all. I think the charitable view is they look at Donald Trump and they say, how in the hell did that guy get elected? And if he can do it, I can do it. The less the more cynical version, of course, is that for some of these folks, at least they're just in it for the book deal, the cable commentator deal, or, you know, the national visibility that comes along with, you know, whatever race you can. Again, at this point in time, you know, you announce yourself running for president, and all of a sudden you're ending up on CNN for an hour-long, you know, cable show or debate, if you will. So, you know, I hope that's not the case, but the cynic in me thinks that for some of them, they're looking for, they're playing the longer game, and unfortunately it revolves around trying to promote their own brand at the expense of the party.
So what's your understanding then of, you've suggested there are some reasons why there's so many in this race that they look at Trump and say, my God, if he could be president, I could be president. But aren't they starting to notice how crowded the field is? Are you going to end up on stage A in a debate with, what, 10 or 12, or stage B? I know people like Cory Booker who aren't doing that well. They're not in the top two or three. Think that their chance to shine is in the debate, and that's how they'll come up in the polls.
Yeah, their so-called breakout moment. I think that's probably driving it for right now.
Right.
There's been a series of polls. Now, you can question how accurate they are in recent days, showing all sorts of movement, especially Biden up and the rest of the pack, you know, losing steam, with the exception maybe of Elizabeth Warren. You know, they can hang on. You know, again, June is right around the corner. They can hang on with minimal staffing to get by with decent fundraising. I mean, for some of these folks, I must admit I'm not following their fundraising, but I assume they're, you know, getting some decent-sized small-dollar donations, and then they're hoping for the breakout in their appearances starting in June.
But how are they going to decide which – if you split the field in two, say you've got 12 – on the stage one night and 12, the other 12 on the stage the next night, how are they going to rank them in terms of, would the top 12 be on one night and the bottom 12 on the next? Do you know how it's going to work?
I have no idea. Honestly, I got to tell you, I just think it's rather ridiculous. But as I've suggested earlier, you know, I've resigned myself that that's, in fact, what's going to happen. We're having a debate within the party, as you and I have talked about before, and I welcome that. I, for one, am not shy about, you know, a vigorous exchange of views. I think, as I've told you before, if you look past the last election, you can't help but question, you know, what the heck happened. And, you know, we need to have a real serious conversation about where we're going and how we're going to get there as a party. But again, it's unfortunately, you know, we don't have leaders right now, or the leadership necessary to try and winnow the field. So it's going to have to happen on their own. So the easy answer is, you know, after a couple of these debates, the fundraising is going to dry up, and then these folks are going to be forced to drop out. That's the, you know, I don't claim to know, you know, how this process works with CNN, but that is the reality of the situation. If, you know, money is the mother's milk of politics, you know, that's whatever funding they have is going to dry out very quickly after one or two of those debates.
Well, Jim Manley, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jim Manley, a D.C.-based independent public affairs consultant, Democratic strategist, and a 21-year veteran of the United States Senate, where he served as a senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for his last 6 years in the Senate, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
A lady dressed in white with a man she loved. Standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night. Just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305.